Solari subscribers, a very interesting discussion today with Dr. Andrew Kilgore, dentist par excellence. And we're here in Cincinnati, Ohio at Affinia Dental, the Mason office, which is his main office. And I think you'll find this very interesting. So, Andrew, say hello and tell us a little bit about your background.
Hello. I guess starting back to when I was a salesman, I'm a second career dentist. And I've worn a lot of hats from beginning in college being a wilderness instructor to helping my wife go through medical school and trading that backpack in for a business suit, training with Pitney Bowes and selling postage meters. And dental equipment came after when a headhunter said, hey, you can do a little better financially if you get into this industry. And in an event to improve myself, we took some dental training in Oklahoma with a mom and pop store that was developing a new technique for doing root canals. And so that was my first journey into dentistry, and where the passion for the sciences really kicked in for the first time.
So this was a kind of a startup company that was doing something with root canals.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah, there was.
So tell me about your education background before then.
So I started out with a philosophy degree at University of Kansas and took a scholarship to train in philosophy to finish at Vanderbilt University. So I transferred midway through college and was supposed to be an environmental lawyer. That was the career path that I thought I was following, and fell in love with wilderness and guiding trips, and worked for Vanderbilt Outdoor Recreation, guiding kayaking trips, taking on one great memory was 11 freshmen ladies down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon with a fellow worker of mine, and guiding them in a week through the canyon and all that fun stuff. And we just idealized the outdoors and really had built a resume to eventually work for Voyager Outward Bound Schools based out of Ely, Minnesota. And I ended up guiding in the Beartooth Range and the Continental Divide Trails with them. So that was sort of the academic part blending with the thing I was called to do.
We transferred to Vanderbilt. Did you graduate with a degree in philosophy?
I certainly did.
And then you went to work right after that for the Outward Bound and wilderness type stuff.
That's right.
Then your wife went to med school and you said, hey, I better get a real job. So you said, I think I'll be a dentist.
Almost. It was almost that leap. We ended up living in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, while she was finishing medical school. And that's when I took the job with Pitney Bowes. And they trained me from the bottom up as far as basic sales school and training, sending me down to Atlanta. And I started rising through the ranks with that first difficult job as a 23-year-old.
And then you went to selling dental equipment.
Yeah, I did. And I don't know if in part it was because I was sort of jealous of Kara. She gets to be a doctor and I don't. One of the difficult things that you realize is on the sales side is your quota is going up every month despite how well you do the month before. And so in forecasting the next 5 to 10 years of what that life would look like, I felt some pressure like, boy, I could never really escape the pressure of direct sales. And as I began familiar with dentists, I called on dentists, thousands of them between Illinois and Wisconsin, there was one event that happened that really affected the way my choices went forward. And that had to do with a dentist that was probably 85 years old. His hands were shaking. And I was calling on him. He had the biggest smile on his face. And this is, you know, quite possibly somebody that would have retired many years before, but he was doing it because he just had a love for the craft. And you could tell that he was getting such intense joy out of the patient relationships and reaching people multi-generationally. Can't say that word.
Multi-generationally.
Seeing the stories play out, and I was like, wow, that's a totally different career path. And I was moving through the ranks as a salesperson and was leading a team at that point. And I was like, you know what? I don't even know if I can take a science course. I'm a philosophy major. I could write papers pretty well, but I didn't even – the most science I had taken up to that point was like a basic level geology course. But I just kind of dumped it and wanted to see if I could do it. I knew it would be a big transformational journey as far as using the other side of my brain.
So a key point here is, as a dental equipment salesperson, you were able to see a lot of dentist practices. You were able to take a look into that industry before you even decided to go into it. So that's going to come into play importantly here very shortly. But so is there anything that you want to tell us about dental school in particular and that ordeal? And then we'll go on to the most interesting part once you get out and what happens.
Yeah, I think I don't know if my brain had developed to a point where I could handle academia on a different level or this level. I wouldn't say it was a higher level than philosophy, but it was such a relaxing and invigorating experience working out black and white sciences, real concrete, not abstract issues. It was like if you could arrive to the end of any of these thought processes, it was 100% right or wrong. And it was kind of refreshing to be able to measure sort of your accomplishment. So I found it incredibly easy, doing very well through that, being able to get through dental school just extremely fast with the enjoyment of the intellectual journey. And I just realized, you know, sort of so many things I'd been told about learning and what you're capable of is opposite the way, you know, it was ingrained in me from dental school. You're either good at math or you're good at English. You can't be both. That was the lesson that was sort of described to me when I was growing up. And I just found out that the more that we're applying our brain power into that subject matter, it's just like a muscle, physical, and your body, it just works and adapts so quickly to the challenges that's presented in front of it. So I had a blast. I had an absolute blast going through dental school.
Okay, so you get out. What happens?
I was getting ready to start a residency. I did well enough to get accepted into a residency that was going to take me 3 years further into dental school. And my wife at that point was kind of like, hey, I'm a medical doctor. And by the time this deal is over, you're going to have been through school longer than me. And so we kind of took a little bit of a pause and simultaneously an opportunity arose where a classmate and I were able to join the first and only U.S. franchise model in the United States out in Colorado. I'd always wanted to live out there. That was backpacker's dream. And so living there and getting to spend time there was always something I dreamt about. So we left school, went out there and started our first of two dental practices.
And you went to school at?
University of Louisville, Kentucky. So we went out, took the first dental job, and it was strange because you're out there in your first experience working on people. You really don't have a lot of knowledge other than maybe you could do to hurt somebody, but you don't have any of the advanced concepts that really tell you how to do good dentistry. It's not, at least in most dental schools, I would say they're playing a little bit of catch up as far as the innovation, technology, the principles based on survival studies that would allow us to put things in the body in a way that's really predictable and helpful to the not just the patient's overall health, but their experience. And that was the journey.
So a survival study refers to a technology, perhaps a new technology, and how long it might last given the application in the human body?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So as the guys, our forefathers in dentistry became a little more sophisticated, they ended up finding ways to, for example, fatigue, you know, the dental crown and the materials that are inside of a dental crown. How many compressions would it take to just destroy one or disrupt the glue? Taking it from that example to what is a 3-unit bridge, which maybe some of the listeners have, how long can these things last over the course of time versus a 4-unit bridge? And there's definitely correlations once they started putting these long-term survival studies on dentistry. And so these things keep getting usually better every year if we stay on top of the data.
But at the point when you first started practicing, it was a bit of a gray area. They didn't know nearly as much as they needed to.
I think some people around the country definitely were paying attention to dentistry from this perspective, but the place that I went to was really not so much focused on material sciences and doing better, faster dentistry. They maybe had a different focus on some other things.
Well, rather than get into too much detail about that, because these themes are going to come up.
Mm-hmm.
What made you leave?
There was two simultaneous events. One, we were living at pretty high altitude, and my son, second born son, his name is Noah. He was born with Down syndrome. So the day he was born, he came home needing bottled oxygen. So he's suffering with low oxygen saturation levels. So we kind of tried to do it in Colorado for the remainder of that first year. And we were just realizing he was losing probably some brain cells to being undersaturated on a daily basis. And the second thing that changed is I had been hearing of other maybe camps within dentistry that were pursuing some of the goals about like survival studies and how to do dentistry in a better, more predictable way. And those are things I was definitely interested in.
So would it be fair to say in a general sense that you had certain aspirations for excellence that were perhaps not shared by that first practice?
That goes without a doubt. And you don't realize that fully coming out of dental school until you've actually lived it. And then maybe reflect on articles, journals, things that would say, here's a better way of doing it. And some of those ideas were really not encouraged. They were, in fact, kind of pushed back by the previous organization. So that was a huge factor for me, is we could do financially very well in that previous model, but if it wasn't being done at the high standard that I could imagine it doing, especially dealing with medicine and this stuff going into people's bodies, that I was held personally. I held myself accountable to make a transition to go find that. So that's when we decided to leave and head back towards the Midwest.
You also mentioned to me that as part of their model, they had their own lab, and you weren't always that happy with the quality of the product coming out of that lab, but you didn't really have a choice to go elsewhere.
Yeah, that's true. It was very discouraged that we would find a higher quality, better fitting type of material. And you really didn't know from the quality standards of dental school what a good crown and what a bad crown or type of material would perform like. And so that wasn't really on a radar as far as calibrating a higher, more excellent standard and precision for dentistry, because I didn't know better. So the dental school maybe didn't have the, you know, top performing labs. That was my baseline. I went out to Colorado. The standard might have been a little bit worse, some days better, some days worse, but there was an option C where it was just excellent. And that was, that wasn't really known to me until I started talking to my classmates that had been out there for a few years, and they were having a totally different experience with materials than I had been doing.
Okay, so this is a very key point. You come out of dental school without a real good sense of what excellence looks like.
That is absolutely my experience. And it's not even the material standpoint. In dentistry, it's fascinating because you really have to blend the patient care connection problem with the materials part and also the business part, which isn't even explained or trained or maybe in one class at dental school over 4 years. So you've got a quite complicated professional education that most people, in order to get really good, need to go train a whole bunch later.
And where do you get that additional training post dental school?
Mm. So there are institutions, I would say there's probably four that have held dominance as far as postgraduate general dentistry education. That would be maybe a gifted specialist in prosthodontics or periodontist. They would teach the dentist, the paying dentist, how to do procedures at their level, giving the general dentist exposure into more advanced dentistry. And you could follow curriculums through these centers and pick up stuff that you'd never get in dental school.
And from the certificates on the wall that I see in your office, you went to quite a few of these seminars.
Yeah, it's, you know, the one of the centers that I attended, I was so impressed with. I went to his first session, and it was a curriculum of 10 sessions flying out to Seattle. And he was the only guy that on the first day of class, and he was already renowned being a world-class, one of the best dentists in the entire world, but he showed us his failures. Most of the dental continuing education events you'd find on the circuit are people that are throwing their best stuff up. And this guy was is a master teacher, and he would be humble enough, know how good he was in his own skin to go, I finished this case in graduate school, and this thing fell apart the next week. Let's figure out why it fell apart. And he had the foresight to document everything with pictures that would show how these patients would progress over time. And it was exciting because it really set free that the dentist, anything that dentists basically will touch that goes from our man hands into the mouth or woman's hands into the mouth will have a failure rate given enough time. So once that he was vulnerable enough to say it will fail, but he goes after the why and how do you keep it up the longest possible way based on, you know, the placement of angulation of that tooth within the mouth and the type of materials and also assessing the patient risk with these things that we put in the mouth and teaching them how to use them properly instead of, you know, putting it in their mouth and not telling them don't eat rocks, you know, that type of stuff, that patient management issue really changed sort of the perspective about how to become a better healer for patients overall.
So you tend to be a bit modest, and I want you to try not to be to answer this question. When you take a look around at the degree of dental care, how would you rate yourself next to other dentists? Are you top 10%, top 5%, top 1%? Where do you rate?
I would say, you know, there's probably one or two dentists in every metropolitan area that have a command of the information that I have and the passion to do it. So I would say that's probably where I would fall, is in a regional area. I'm going to say that it's hard to really toot your own horn, but if you're fixing a lot of other mistakes that other people created, then you kind of know where you stand. Or if you start taking abandonment cases with patients that can't get solutions anywhere else in your region, then you start to know, yeah, maybe I'm a little gifted in those areas.
So are we talking about 50 or 100 miles around Cincinnati, roughly?
I'll have people coming from different states. I wouldn't say they come from more than a state away, but if they have special problems, and they'll hear about us and have reached the end of solutions in their local area, they'll find us here and we'll get them some help.
So there might be two or three people in this entire area, you being one of them, that are the top of the heap.
It's really hard bragging your own horn, but yeah, I think that's probably where that stands. Okay.
I just want the audience to understand that, because that's what I've also seen from my time being spent with you, that you're truly exceptional, which is why I wanted to spend this time with you and now get into the most important stuff we're going to talk about, which is the current state of dental care in the United States. So first, you might want to let the audience know just what, you know, the types of things that you do that require some special skill. And then let's talk about the state of dentistry.
Okay. So there's sort of two components that help us stand apart from other practitioners. And the first one is a patient management issue. It's a shift in thinking about what does that relationship feel like when we're bringing a patient into the practice. In my opinion, dentists, by the previous model, stand behind their DDS degree or their DMD degree with a sort of I'm the expert status, and I'm going to do things to you and you're going to accept them because I'm the dentist. And I think that's been the way this thing's been played out for 80 years. What I have found to be the solution for most of our issues is being extremely collaborative with the patients. And what I mean by that, in designing their dental plan, their dental treatment. And what I mean by that is really seeking to ask the question about what their primary motivator is, both behind why they are seeking dental care. And that isn't my tooth usually is, you know, my tooth is broken, that's why I'm here today. Well, in the previous model, the dentist would fix the tooth. But what we're trying to seek in comprehensive care inside of dentistry is a emotional undercurrent that actually motivated them to show up to get healthy. And if we can find that by listening very carefully, the patients will treatment plan themselves for us. We have so many options inside of dentistry. I mean, the complexity is enormous. In dental school, we're taught give them three options. They just made up three, but give them three, you know, a high, medium, and low. And instead of just kind of heading this thing off to the pass and going, what's the primary motivation? Because we can then sling the treatment options in sequence by what the patient's desires ultimately are. And the fact that if we don't do it that way and they don't get the education and the motivation behind keeping it all together when they're done with treatment, the whole thing falls apart anyway. So I've got, before we do a large restorative case involving thousands of dollars and a big commitment from these patients, sometimes multiple IV visits that will assemble this, we'd better know that the gear that goes into the head is going to be protected by them when they go home at night. So the motivation, the primary motivator is a huge, is a huge shift, because it's like I'm putting my doctor card down and I want to collaboratively design this, helping the patients with their problem.
But part of this also is being very explicit about the challenges involved and the responsibilities that they may have in making this care successful, correct?
Yeah, you're spelling it out. You're spelling out the outcome. You're focused on the treatment outcome. You're portraying and allowing the patient through some brief description about what this reality, what this appliance, what this rehabilitation in their mouth is going to feel like. And you're going to name all the bad stuff that could go wrong with it. You're pointing out the risks and benefits of having this stuff permanently installed and seeing if the patient can buy into it and say, yeah, this is the outcome I want. And I do believe that I can deal with the risks of this appliance. I mean, sometimes the complexity might involve something like they can't keep things clean because their hands, they're in later stage of life and their hands can't, they don't have the dexterity to maintain appliances that they might have when they were younger. That stuff needs to be discussed very carefully at the very beginning, because it does affect treatment outcome.
Give a few more examples.
Well, let's say, we're doing more and more cases of patients that will come in that have spent a lot of money in their mouth, and there's nothing really that we can restore back to. Think about the crown that is prepped and it goes to a root canal and a crown redo. And then the crown breaks off 10 years later. And then we're back into implant dentistry. So they've had resources and they just want to get stable. Well, we're in an era today where we can continue to go that route, or we can take out all of their teeth, put implants in the same day, and have fixed bridge work put in so that they leave with temporary complete bridge work. And if their biology was getting in the way in the first place, we decrease that risk entirely, and they're in a brand new restart.
So talk about this this whole biological factor.
Oh, that's one of the most fascinating pieces of this. I mean, we're told that, at least I remember, and this isn't a fault of anything but just U.S. dentistry, maybe gross descriptions, but there are definitely risk factors in terms of genetics that play major roles in periodontal disease, for example. That's the problem where people are having inflammation and bone loss in their gums, and it's rampant across the United States. One every three people has some form of it, and we, because of genetic testing, we're learning so much more about how this one disease affects so many other systemic parts of their health, like heart disease and premature stroke and premature labor and perhaps some Alzheimer's links that are coming out. It's very much linked. There's two different types that I can see right now, and one of them is a genetic predisposition to it. So if one of these patients arrives, we see a tremendous amount of bone loss, and we'll ask them, did mom or dad have a denture early? And they'll universally say, oh yeah, mom lost her teeth when she was 20. That same person with the same amount of care, sitting at the same dinner table that didn't have the genetic markers for periodontal disease could have the same amount of like film on their teeth or calculus on their teeth, and they might not get any bone loss. Their body doesn't react in an inflammatory way against the presence of mineral deposits on teeth. But the person that does, it wipes out the bone very aggressively and very quickly. And that's just to comment to what we know about the whole cavity thing, the tooth structure part. I mean, we see people walking in and they're sad and they're horrified that I have four brothers and sisters and I'm the only one that gets cavities. And all my brothers and sisters are just fine. Same parents, same external diets, but there is something a little off with the mineral content in those teeth. And we are just now starting to get great science on what that's looking like.
Or there might be something in the saliva or some other chemical in the mouth?
No question. I mean, saliva plays a huge part in buffering against acidity. So when we see any mouth above a 5.5, I'm sorry, below a 5.5 pH level. If they're in that acidic realm, a tooth is actually a soft substrate. It just looks hard. But in that acidic environment, minerals are getting sucked out of teeth. And it keeps happening. It keeps happening until the acid attack hits that surface of the tooth, and you actually see a collapse of the circular rods in the teeth. Thus, when those collapse, it's called a cavity. You see, it's a collapse of these little rods that are usually plugged with enamel that are just smashed at that point. And saliva buffers that tooth surface. It keeps raises above 5.5, so we can start getting the body's ability to remineralize it back into that tooth. So it's in flux constantly.
So it's kind of an ionic reaction, right? Because you got these high pluses in the acidic saliva, and then you've got probably some negative ions in the metals, and they basically come out of the tooth and join with the saliva, right?
Yeah, it's definitely fascinating what's happening. And the longer I go, I start to look at the mouth as instead of an isolated cavity, I mean, I've thought this way for years now, but instead of looking at the cavity that's on the tooth, we consider the mouth, the teeth. They're in a fishbowl. The mouth is a fishbowl. And if you see one or two cavities in that mouth, the dentist may react to fix those cavities, but all the teeth in the mouth have actually had a pretty high acid hit. It's the same environment. We're only fixing reactively the teeth that shows the massive part of destruction. The rest of the teeth are going there. So we have to bring high-risk cavity caries patients and get that pH level up really quickly and reestablish that so we can not be in a cycle where we're fixing things that we just fixed. And if I fix something and we don't decrease that risk or address that part of why, I could be back 6 months later fixing the same cavities.
How would you reduce pH in your mouth?
I want to increase pH.
Sorry.
That's okay.
How do you want to increase pH and reduce acidity?
Yeah, so probably the most impactful thing is what you had mentioned before about saliva. Because if we're underproducing saliva, that's our major buffering agent. Incidentally, we're seeing because of chronic medications, the top 200 chronic medications that people would take for any systemic issue.
Like blood pressure.
Absolutely.
Cholesterol.
Huge salivary impact as far as flow. So we're getting a tremendous amount of people, and we're in a new epidemic of trying to control and increase saliva content because they just don't produce anymore. And that is a massive issue, I'd say, that everybody is struggling with people between 50, beginning at age 50 and going forward.
I've never heard of medical doctors telling their patients, you know, if one of the side effects of this blood pressure or cholesterol medication is going to be that your saliva production is going to go way down and your destruction of your teeth is going to go way up.
That's just a fact, and you're right. I mean, we're not really getting to make those decisions. Harry, if it's you, I mean, were you fully informed? Do you have consent? That's a decision that you'd like to make. I mean, you start also, you know, the consequence of losing all these teeth, it's a major health issue as far as mastication when you get into late years. And, you know, I'm really scared and sad when somebody gets up into their advanced ages and they are losing teeth enough that might get them into a denture where they can't fully taste their food or use it. Tasting food is like the last most wonderful thing that you have, and you carry that all the way through life. And if I mess with that, if I impact that, and you don't get to taste what you don't enjoy food, those patients have a trend of not lasting very long.
And I imagine there's quite a self-esteem issue involved with losing your teeth.
Yeah. I mean, we're in Kentucky and, you know, that's kind of cultural in some parts in Ohio, but no, I'm joking with you. It is. It's a,
it means a status symbol in those places.
It certainly is.
Okay. So there's You said there were two ways that you differentiated yourself. One is getting the patient proactively involved and having a very significant feedback loop from them also, which I want to talk about. It's quite fascinating. Mm-hmm. What would be the second theme?
It really has to do with at least the platform of dentistry that I was given. We understood the periodontal part. We understood the biomechanical part, things that does the tooth need a crown? Is there a crack in it? How do you fix it? Does the tooth have a cavity? That's biomechanical issues dealing with the hard stuff.
And you had that understanding coming out of dental school?
Yeah, a little bit. Maybe not fully developed. I mean, so many things change every year. And we also had a decent command on aesthetics, the aesthetics of dentistry, the art part where – you know, what's the shape and what's it supposed to look like to achieve a high aesthetic result? The thing that was really not understood, and I was seeking answers to this, you know, 14 years ago, and that was, how did these things work and function in the mouth? So we eat by chewing. Ideally, we move muscles and jaws in a way that kind of replicates mastication in a cow. So the jaw unhinges, it slides a little forward, and then it retreats and it finds its position to grind. But we don't build teeth to that place. In dental school, you're only taught to build teeth in a up-down position, maybe a little side to side. But that's quite a bit different than actually making patients and test crowns, fillings, temporaries that come out, dentures. It's all the same. By actually using them the way that they would use when they're at home.
So not just a bite up and down, but let's see you chew, how you chew. And there's a lot of movement side to side and in other dimensions.
A lot of variability too. I mean, it's a very unique sort of tracing about how people use the jaw. So if we can do some very simple things, I have picked up through me just asking a lot of questions chairside involving the patients in their treatment. And this would be that shift. It's collaborative. So I'd say something like, let's say you walked in and you said you had a bunch of clenching and grinding problems. And you don't know why. Well, I would describe a situation about what would the bite feel like if it was perfect? So I'm going to tell you a picture. Hey, it feels like both sides hit in the back of the mouth at the same time with the same pressure. You don't hit the front of your mouth. You don't hit and slide a little bit down to find your home position on your teeth. And then I'd say, Harry, what does your bite feel like? And I have to slow them down. They have to really calm us, close their eyes, because we're teaching them something that they aren't even aware of. So, for example, if a dentist went in to their mouth 30 years ago and they put a crown in that was too high, and the dentist didn't understand what I call physiologic occlusion, which is what we're speaking to right now. The patient might go, oh, I'm numb. So that's why this thing feels a little weird. And maybe they go back to the dental office and the dentist then goes, oh, you'll get used to it. It's going to be fine. It's a little bit high right now. And I would bet most of the listeners have gone through this. I mean, it's epidemic. That's a major problem, because human beings will adapt to what they're given. But the question becomes, to at what price? Are we going to adapt by grinding and clenching this rock that was glued in their mouth 30 years ago? Are they going to grind through that in a completely uncontrolled way in the middle of the night when the brain's just trying to seek equilibrium to get things to rest in the mouth? Or are they going to advance or position their jaw in some way, maybe a little off to the left and kicked up 3 millimeters to the right, just to get the other side to close down with this rock that was put on the right side of the mouth?
Which could affect other parts of their anatomy, their shoulders, their neck, chest, breathing, perhaps even?
It's a massive issue with regards to migraine headaches, tension headaches. I mean, you're basically putting somebody in a position where they can't rest. So that if the muscle is firing constantly, seeking a place to rest, the muscles will adapt. The joint can kind of scar into those positions, and they're in a sort of in a, not in the homeostasis position the jaw always meant to be in. So that's an example of approaching the dental treatment from a standpoint of, let's really be careful, because the subjective part of the question, with me telling them what ideal could be, I have to listen to what their responses are, because they're very confused initially. Well, I mean, my bite is the only bite I know. But then you start listening to a collection of symptoms. You can see wear patterns on the teeth. They start talking about sore jaw, muscle pain, headaches that they've had for 30 years. And I mean, these things are very easily treated. We just have to show them what the end is.
So one of the key things you're saying here too is that not only do you have to be keyed into listening to the patient, but that the patient, with the right kind of coaching, is able to give you very significant feedback, even under when their tooth is so-called numb.
Yeah, it's, and maybe this has to do with my background in sales, because when I was selling to, you know, people, I am asking enough questions to get them to basically tell me what motivates them, what do they want or need. So in me wearing the shoes as a dentist, I have found that dentistry gets extremely predictable if you are having this story, this sort of protocol played out and involve the, it's happening, the dentist is doing things to me, versus the dentists are simply the hands and we're walking down that path together and I'm making recommendations and asking questions. My dentistry got a lot better when I actually started listening very, very carefully to the patients and the associates that I have now. I'm like, guys, you got to put your doctor's cards down. And I want you to assume one thing, no matter what the patients are actually describing to you or telling you, they are always right. Don't blow them off. You may not be able to see it, but if you're tenacious at listening and asking them a question deeper, I almost always resolve patients back to that perfect symmetry and that craving of restfulness that they intrinsically know in themselves they want. It's sort of like human beings have a home position. We all just want to get there. That's what I'm trying to encourage the associates to do, is have that dialogue. It's a subtle thing. It's a subtle dialogue, but it's definitely, it's almost like a protocol where if you assume they're right and you make the little adjustments based on what those recommendations are the patient's giving you, you get there 100% of the time. That's my experience.
So there's a lot of training of people, I guess, when they come in, right, from dental school and maybe even other practices. You spend a lot of effort coaching, training, nurturing.
Yeah. Our model is just a little bit different because of the training that I took after I got out of dental school. It was an excessive amount. I mean, I have taken so much continuing education that I don't even use probably half of it. A lot of it was junk continuing education. The real good stuff that elevates the platform for dentistry, we try to take those principles and bring them down to the associates. And so when I hire an associate, what I'm looking for is insatiable ability to process information and also compassion, extreme compassion for patients. I can
so a high learning metabolism.
Yeah, they have
to. Compassion.
They have to, and sort of that relentless desire to know they're on a journey in their careers where they're never going to have all the answers. They're going to get better, but these updates need to happen continually and just make it part of the journey. It's going to be constant, never ending improvement in the way we deliver dentistry, and there's a humility. So when I bring on an associate, I basically say, hey, guys, if you find a better approach to doing what we're doing right now, And this goes from the doctors or the hygiene team, any person in the company that can find a better, faster, and easier way based on science, sometimes based on a more efficient approach. If you are a dentist or hygienist and we exist in that model, we all switch. So best science wins. And that allows us to buy world-class products at economies of scale and not have, you know, 10 different endodontic systems or 10 different filling material methods. The chaos of that would be overwhelming. And so we can get the best stuff, but we're all going down that way together.
It might be important to mention that you have four practices, right?
Yes.
And at one time, a major goal of yours, which to a certain extent you still have, was to create a chain of really good dental shops, right? Maybe even on a national scale.
Yeah, I think I think that's the path that we're on right now, and I think we have a lot to contribute to U.S. dentistry. I want to do this in step with great people that do have the same passion for dentistry and want to hold up and tell a really long term good story, and so we would grow in step with that.
What we're seeing in this industry, I think, because it's relatively high margin and, you know, the accountants start looking at people's P&Ls, is that there's a lot of private equity guys out there, right, looking for deals where they can put a lot of practices together and make this a financial play. Do you see that happening?
Yes, probably in medicine, on the medical side as well as the dental side, we're seeing just a lot of interest in our industry, margins being quite apart, special compared to any other industry. And so, yes, a lot of the private equity is getting involved in the acquisition of dental practices. I don't know. I can't really speak to if it was quite in the same manner that it happened in medicine, as far as grouping up everybody and massive buyouts of the solo practitioner, but that is what's happening right now.
When we've talked in the past, you've mentioned a fascinating phenomenon involving patients and desiring to be knocked out when they get in the chair. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, one of the sort of ways I specialized myself is I went and took the training to allow me to become board certified in IV sedation. And I was doing some more aggressive oral surgery appointments and implant surgery, and it was just something that people kept asking for. So we went and took care of that, and that's really the same type of sedation that you would get if you went to a medical procedure and got an endoscopy or a colonoscopy. So it's like Versed, fentanyl, kind of. Those are the drug agents we use. And the fascinating part about that journey is there is such a mass subset of people that I believe were physically abused in a dental chair. And it makes sense. I mean, maybe some of it wasn't malicious, but, you know, if you were born in 1950, the anesthetics we know didn't really work until like the late 70s at the best. We actually reformulated the old, Novocaine, which, you know, that was the name brand. I'm not even sure it's really a brand name that existed, but that's what the public used. And what they found out was that old formula, it took 30 minutes around for the onset of profound anesthesia. And the horrifying part is it only lasted for 10 minutes. So you're a 7 to 10-year-old sitting in a dental chair and you need a tooth pulled or a couple. Well, the dentist gets it numb. They wait. Maybe you're numb on that first one, but I highly doubt you're numb on that second one, or the fillings or whatever had to go behind it. And so these patients were essentially held down, threatened, and forced. The dentistry was forced physically into their mouth when they lost all their power. And
they lost all their power and they were basically being tortured in a dental chair. And that's my belief. And I have thousands and thousands of patients that have told me that's exactly what happened. So I know I'm on a little segue, but those patients will come in and they are scared. They're scared as little kids. They turn into that little kid the second they come into the dental chair. So we have to quickly reset this. I mean, some of them are so scared, they won't even sit down in the dental chair. And so to reframe this experience in something to me is not just let's sedate them continually. We obviously do that, but I do one thing automatically. I say, you're my boss and I have to really take care of you or you're not coming back. So I want to give them their power back. Once I know why they had the event, I'm going to give them their power back and also teach them to breathe. We're just looking in their mouths today. I mean, they're terrified. And the second thing is really saying, hey, there, and it goes back to what we described before. There may be a day where you may not need IV sedation to come into the dental office again. It's going to be your call. You've got all the power to decide. Do you want IV sedation? Do you want to maybe try something a little lighter, like oral sedation with a little nitrous oxide? The most exhilarating moment I have isn't the dentistry anymore. It's breaking the psychological fracture that happens to these people that have been abused in a dental chair in the past.
How much of that abuse has been sexual?
It does come up. It does come up more than I would like to admit. It's not as much as just the general physical abuse patient, the loss of power patient, but it does come up. And the longer you do this, you can kind of get a feeling and you just open the dialogue up. But even in that, if we get a sense of that, we always have women in the room with us and I'm the male, so I have to be sensitive to that. If we've got that sort of deal playing out, whether they're willing to talk about it or not, I give them a whole lot of space when I'm in the room. I might not even do the exam in a dental chair. We might take them back to the classroom, send them down. I can still do an exam, and give them the freedom of a new space that doesn't have the smells, the sounds, all of that stuff. Get them to laugh. Getting patients to laugh is probably the one of the biggest, most useful weapons that I have in getting them to play a different record. They're playing. Previously, I'm 6 years old and I'm playing the record of abuse with all these sound, sights, and smells, and I've lost my power. And I want to crush that record and I want to take a new one off and I want to reprogram them to a better day when they're on their own feet and they don't need all the drugs to do it. So I think, and when we get them through that high level phobia fear and they walk in, it's the coolest thing in the world. I mean, it's like, I have 7-year-olds that walk in and it's like they got their big boy pants on. They're coming in. They're just doing a little local anesthesia. And we celebrate that at the end of the appointment. That's a big deal. And they come back for the cleanings and they're involved in their own care. And they're not just, in that place they started. So that's the most fun for me.
Have you found any correlations with diet and dental health?
So on the on the cariogenic front, the cavity side, something to go back to what we were describing earlier in terms of acid. The acid in the first line of defense of something that we drink that has a low pH level hits a tooth. So that's strike one. There is a hit from an acidic drink. I mean, coffee is a lower pH thing. You get acid on the teeth.
Soda
for sure. But that's not really what destroys the teeth. We have a bacteria known as strep mutans. It's everybody's got it to some degree, high degrees. And it's really the metabolism of sugars. When that bacteria that resides in our mouth eats it, the acid output is tremendous. And so imagine this for a second. From the time we drink something with a sugar in it, and I can't even speak to artificial sugar. Some do, some don't have the same effect. But if we take a sip, the bacteria is going to secrete a lot of acid on our teeth for about half an hour. So if a patient is taking a pH level dive below 5.5 because they're sipping these sugars all throughout the day, they are creating a nice fishbowl of acid, and they're not allowing the saliva to hit and buffer the environment so that the tooth has a chance to repair. And we'll see cavities on every single tooth in an 18-year-old's mouth when they're drinking Mountain Dew all day. And it's not because of the initial hit. It's because they're sipping it. So there's things that you can do with different foods to promote a high pH level. But I'm not an expert in a whole lot of other food issues that would contribute. But I am open-minded to learning.
So what messages that we haven't covered would you like to leave with our listeners?
I think patients studying and staying open-minded to the resources that could be available to them. And there's nothing secret to what we're describing today. This information is really out there. If you dig in a little bit, become a master of where your risk is. If your dentist, if you feel like you can't find an answer to why you're still getting cavities in your mouth and your dentist is not providing those solutions, become the expert yourself. Dig in, because those answers are absolutely out there. And remember that there is a end zone. There is a physiologic, neutral, perfect position that we all crave to be in. So trust your instincts about the way you feel. Trust your body. And realize that you need to keep chasing down these answers, whether with another provider or on your own, to get into that place, because it's real. And when you get there, stuff stops falling apart. Pathology starts to cease. And so that's what I would encourage everybody to consider.
How does somebody go about finding a good dentist like you? Give us some tips on how to do that.
I think your best bet is everybody will do pretty good research. Look for dentists that are less important about their own alkaloids, but more important that they've done some and believe in continuing and never ending improvement through continuing education, that they're open. I would not go to any dentist that is not doing, that's just doing the bare minimum of what's required is in terms of continuing education in your state. It's not enough. Look for signs of flow in the dental office. You need to have the front office answering the phone feeling really great to you, the way that they're handling you in a professional manner, and processing if you have some insurance benefits or something you want to bring on. That flow is a sign in the front that you can see, as well as what's probably happening in the back. You'll do your research on the review sites that you can find. And, you know, I would really encourage patients to back off from the initial comprehensive exam and ask for more of a, would the dentist give them 15 minutes just for a meet and greet and show around the practice to see if the philosophy of practice is in alignment with what the patient feels like. Anybody that really wouldn't be willing to do that, that would really help you eliminate a lot of the errors that could be made in choosing a dentist that isn't yoked to the way you need to be treated. I'd look for things outside of things that within the practice that they're committed to, mission work, for example, things that have to do with serving in a way that you can see that they're, that the teams are prospering because the dentist is committing to some type of local or international mission work. I think it says a lot about where their heart is and how the receiving component, the patient, is a big part of this process. Those would be things that I would look at.
Could you name a few of these continuing education organizations that you respect?
Yeah, the COIS Center, K-O-I-S Center in Seattle, Washington, in my opinion, is the best. That's where I did this training. And they have a website that with a patient link, and you can quickly get into that site and see if there are any COIS providers in your area. That would be the first place that I would start.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I'm in pretty good shape. I've enjoyed getting to talk about some of this stuff. I think one other subject matter that I think is going to shift gears on this as we go forward is the fluoride issue. It's super controversial. And I think there is a ton of science out there to support that this is not something that really should be systemically taken and ingested into our bodies. And that really that, you know, we are brainwashed in dental school. Fluoride is the panacea for everything. And I think it has an application when it's not ingested. It can help with making tooth structure harder, but it's only now becoming one of many components that can do that same thing. And so I would be paying attention to anything that comes out regarding water fluoridation. It doesn't really make sense to me that it is in the water supply, and I don't think there's any basis for it. So I will definitely be against my peers in that department.
And how about mercury fillings? And in our discussions, we talked a little bit about how sometimes if you've had mercury fillings in your mouth, it may not be the best way to just run and get them taken out. So can you expound a little bit on that?
Yeah, that's a really important one. So I try to base things in a very pragmatic way. And there is controversy about the metal or amalgam fillings and the contents of those fillings. The verbiage of amalgam is a conglomeration of a bunch of different things. So I don't really want to be an expert on what those components are. I can tell you that if I have to remove a metal filling, sometimes it's really hard to get out, and sometimes it's like soft. It's almost like mush. So metal fillings are not in anywhere. They don't constitute the same type of filling material. I think they were an incredible tool, and that's what we had for so many years. And a metal filling, we've seen them last for, you know, decades. So I try to steer off the controversy of what's in it. So I don't want to tell a patient there's mercury in the filling, because that may be true, but I just don't have a lot of command saying that that's putting a whole lot of risk to the patient. I know that when we take out a metal filling, we're releasing it. We're releasing the vapors. And so probably the person that's getting most of the hit on that is probably the dentist that's removing and breathing that.
So, how high revving is some of are these drills? And basically, what you're doing, is it from the heat or just from the speed that you're creating this aerosol?
Yeah. So these things can go 100 to 200,000 RPMs. We're spraying a lot of water on it, and it's, you know, it's shooting everywhere. I mean, this stuff is getting absolutely everywhere. So we try to use special suction devices that pull it before it does get out of the mouth. But, you know, we don't create a biohazard where to get these things out. I mean, it's just not economical, practical. So if a patient wants to get them out, we're happy to do it. But we'd like to do it for a different reason. What I see on metal fillings is a very pragmatic failure, because metal fillings over time, they shrink a little bit, very subtly. We'll start to see leakage points between the place where the metal touched the tooth. Now we got little gaps between the tooth and the filling, and that's where we start getting cavities.
And also, you got two different expansion coefficients between metal and enamel, right?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. So imagine we've got something shrinking. It's not filling it the way that it was, but the tooth is still getting loaded. The number one thing that dentists fix in the mouth are amalgam fillings that have been watched too long. and they act like nails in teeth.
That have been what too long?
Watched.
Watched?
Yeah, we're watching it to failure. You're watching it have the little leaks. You're watching the little cracks that start to happen. Well, those cracks are, it's a physical wedging effect that is happening by hammering these teeth. Sometimes they will split teeth. You'll lose an entire cusp. And that's the number one reason why we have to do crowns. Sometimes they fracture teeth off below the gum line. And there's no warning on these things. So my recommendation is be reasonable and prudent about it. If you're getting some work done and you've got some metal fillings and you happen to be numb in that part of the mouth, get them all taken out and redo them. Put a composite filling that is not destructive in the tooth. Keep small holes, small holes. Don't let them become bigger problems that involve more tooth reduction. When we take away tooth structure, there is still no material that replaces the dentin and enamel complex. We haven't figured it out yet. So we still will have failure within the things we put into the body. We don't have the perfect enamel dentin complex that we can put back in there. So you really want to just be conservative and try to get ahead of everything, not wait for the failure symptoms to happen.
And what's in these composites today?
It's a plastic, and then you have different fillers inside these plastics. And it's inert for the most part. It's light cured or dual cured into the tooth. Think of it as a really sort of hardened plastic that has different resins. And when it's locked in there, it doesn't have a lot of expansion. It does have a little bit of subtraction over time, but the property of it is chemically bonded into the tooth. It's not mechanically shoved in a tooth. So what that allows us to do is take less tooth structure out of a preparation site. So those metal fillings have to have huge metal undercuts because you're stuffing that in there and then they get locked in. We are chemically bonding, that is. So like bonding, if you imagine you had a dark spot on your tooth you'd want to repair, we can bond right to that surface, right to that outer enamel, as if we haven't touched the underlying tooth structure. So when a composite fails, unfortunately, they don't last as long as the metal filling. We can hold those fillings up to about 10, 12 years if they're done correctly, but they will also fail. So it's sort of like a tire on a car. It's going to need some maintenance, but I would rather have that tiny composite filling gently taken out and then put another one in versus the catastrophic event that can happen when you're doing the metal.
Tell us about gold and its role in the dental industry today.
Boy, I don't see a whole lot of gold anymore. We don't do metal anything in our practices anymore. Gold, in my opinion, still, I'm so shocked about how long these crowns and onlays and inlays still last to this day. I mean, the properties of gold is pretty amazing. I'd say it's probably the longest thing we've got. It's cost prohibitive right now for most people. We're off the charts as far as the gold prices. But labs will still manufacture gold. A lot of the camps will still, like the higher institutes of learning will still put gold crowns in the furthest back parts of the tooth where the load is really significant. That's sort of something that seems to have tremendous longevity are those restorations in the back of the mouth.
And it probably has some long longevity too.
Oh yeah. Sorry.
Anything else? This has been absolutely fabulous. I think that our listeners will really appreciate the fact that you've given us this time.
Well, this is really fun for me. I mean, there's a lot of assumptions being made out there that I think should always be questioned, like so many other areas in life. And dentistry is one that, you know, it's in my wheelhouse. So hopefully we'll be doing some pretty cool stuff out of Ohio in the next few years.
And recently you became a Solari.com subscriber, right?
Oh, yeah. It is a phenomenal resource for me on the weekends, and I love every bit about the production, and I enjoy it so much more. It's a calming way to get real information as opposed to some of the crazy stuff that I would listen to. I mean, I enjoy a mature appraisal of the subject matter, and we've got science and sourcing to support it. And I like it that the information is resting where it is, and it's, you know, you can get nice advances in your own development on subject matter, but you don't have to have all the tremendous anxiety that goes with it as compared to some of the other.
The fear porn, as Catherine says.
That's my experience of it. As I get older, I kind of like the slower, easy, more digestible, non-adrenaline version of this information.
Andrew Kilgore, Affinia Dental, Cincinnati, Ohio. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Harry.
Thank you.